We're going to get ourselves started here. Our title for today is Our Muslim Neighbors, Part 3. Who is my Muslim neighbor? We think there's a question in there that we need to address before we all go home. Who is my Muslim neighbor? Unfortunately, I think this is a question that we can't really answer for you. We don't know where you live. We don't know what your neighborhood looks like. I grew up in a small town in Ohio called Marysville. Marysville is a great place to grow up. Let's just say it's not a very cosmopolitan place. I have a brother and sister sitting there. They can correct me if they think I'm wrong. I'm pretty sure there wasn't a single Muslim living in Marysville the whole time I lived there. Muslims, for me, were people I could read about in National Geographic. Right? That's about the way it was for me then. But now I'm living on the other end of the spectrum, living in the greater Detroit area, and it's a very different situation. And we, you know, our definitions of neighborhood, those are shifting. The internet is changing a lot of things. Who was my Muslim neighbor 40 years ago? Who is my Muslim neighbor now? What does that word mean? Context matters, and everybody has a different context. So what we're hoping this morning is to tell you some stories and to give you some observations about neighborly interaction. And we are hoping that you can find your context in here somewhere as we tell some of these stories and give some of these observations. Me first. A lot of people don't get involved with their Muslim neighbors because they are afraid. And it is a daunting thing to do. It does raise perplexing questions. And I'll grant you that. So, yes, be prepared for some difficulty. Be prepared for some daunting questions. But I would urge you, press through those things and do it anyway. In Michigan, and actually in the greater Midwest area, we have a foundation called the Niagara Foundation. The Niagara Foundation sponsors frequent opportunities for, it's not just interreligious experience, but intercultural experience. And just a few months this summer, to give you an example, during Ramadan, they will be inviting people like me to get together in the homes of Muslims who live around the Rochester Hills area, and we share in an iftar meal. And those are fabulous experiences. There's fun, there's good conversation, and there's some really good food. It's a great thing to do, and it's something that I involve my daughters in as well. Last year, Niagara sponsored a trip for a group of Rochester College students and faculty, and we all went to Turkey. It was an amazing, fast-paced week. And I just want to tell you about one incident. One particular morning, as we were in Turkey, we ate breakfast in a private residence in the city of Izmir. Izmir in the Bible is called Smyrna. Okay, still there. About 3 million people now living in the city of Izmir, and almost all of them Muslims. And five times a day, beginning very early in the morning, they have a call to prayer. And if you've ever heard the call to prayer, you have, I can't imitate it for you this morning. It's quite an experience to be awakened at 5:23 in the morning by the call to prayer. But anyway, back to the breakfast. I was talking about the breakfast. While we were eating this breakfast, a couple of musicians came into the house, and they began to play for us. They were really good. They would play, and then they would talk and play, and they would talk. And we learned in the course of this that one of these guys was the primary muezzin for the city of Izmir. In other words, it was his voice that was usually being piped all across the city calling literally millions of Muslims to prayer five times a day. And his voice was absolutely amazing. So I asked him, are you going to be doing the call to prayer tomorrow morning? Because if you are, I will set my alarm, I will be awake, and I will be alert, and I will listen. And he said, well, no, sadly, I'm not on the schedule for tomorrow morning. I have a colleague on the schedule. But, he said, we could trade. And I thought, oh, I can't ask him to trade. That doesn't seem right. And then he said, wait. Tell you what, I'll do it here. And so there we are. It's about 9:30 in the morning in this small dwelling with families living on either side. And he stands there right in the dining room, and he belts out the early morning call to prayer. And like I said, his voice was amazing. His face was a picture of devotion. I am not the kind of person who looks for spiritual moments. I am not the kind of person who looks for thin spaces. I was not tempted to convert to Islam. But that moment was deeply affecting for me. And I, as a Christian, really sensed the majesty and the beauty of God. And some people get nervous when I talk like this. Can a Christian be inspired by the Islamic call to prayer? Are we allowed to do that? I think that's a fair question. Here's the thing, though. I would rather be plagued with difficult questions than to not have an experience like the one I had in Izmir. I'd much rather have that experience. I'd much rather have those questions. Similar questions are being asked, and you may have heard this news story. It comes from December. In the aftermath of the Connecticut school shootings in Newtown, there was an interfaith prayer service in the high school auditorium, and President Obama was there, and there were representatives from lots of different world religions, and of course, there were representatives from Christian and Muslim communities there. One of the Christian participants was a pastor from the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. His name is Rob Morris, and he was chosen to give a prayer because his congregation had lost one of their members in the shootings. Now, if you know much about the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, you know that it's a fairly conservative fellowship, and they have a rule that its pastors are not allowed to worship with people from non-Christian faiths. And this event was televised nationally, so you might say word got back to the front office pretty quickly. And Pastor Morris, he defended himself by saying, listen, I didn't feel like I was worshiping with people. I felt like I was a chaplain. I went there to represent the Christian faith. But he was rebuked by the presidency of the synod, and he very humbly accepted the rebuke, and he apologized. And then, in a really interesting twist, the president of the Missouri Synod issued an apology to Pastor Morris saying, I really didn't handle this thing very well at all. Okay, well, now, as you can surely imagine, there were a lot of people who were upset with Pastor Morris. There are people who were upset with him because he gave a prayer in that context, but then there are people who are upset with him because he apologized for giving the prayer. And there are people who are upset with the Missouri Synod because they were so hard-headed and inflexible with Pastor Morris. And then there are people who are upset with the Missouri Synod because they apologized. It's messy. It just is. And if you are really, truly going to interact with your Muslim neighbors, I'll tell you, I think it's going to lead you into some delicate and difficult situations. It could make you feel perplexed. It could raise tough questions. And I think it could very well, there's a really good chance of this, it could perplex your brothers and sisters in Christ as well and could lead to some difficult situations. So what do we do with this? Do we throw caution to the winds, or do we play it safe? Here's my conviction on the matter. We need to do something. And I would much rather take the risk of being perplexed than to take the risk of being indifferent. I would rather be a bumbling witness than to be no witness at all. I would challenge you. I don't know where you live. I don't know your context. Find the nearest mosque. Look in the website. Find out when they have Friday prayers. And visit. There are very few mosques in the country that would not welcome a visitor who wants to know something about Islam. And go so that you can meet these people and see what happens. I would challenge you to look for organizations that can get you connected. You know, in Michigan, we have the Niagara Foundation. The parallel out here in California is called the Pacifica Foundation. There are others. They probably won't take you to Turkey, but they might give you an iftar meal, okay, and it's really cool. They're wonderful opportunities. Whatever you do, do something. If Jesus has changed the way you treat other people, and if you want to testify to that change, do something. One of the best examples I have, people who are willing to think outside the box and do something, would be John and Sarah Barton. And so I'm going to let John talk next about something they did this past November.
Maybe one of the best ways we can describe what we're trying to do today is just to offer some challenges and get us all thinking creatively and offer a few anecdotes for some examples of hospitality. And as Keith said, we've been extended hospitality from the Muslim community in the Detroit area and elsewhere a number of times. Sarah and I, last year, we all often try to think, what are some creative ways that we can offer some hospitality in return? How can we enter into this? And we often get ourselves in over our head. But here's one example. I want to show you a picture of a wonderful day that we had. This is Thanksgiving 2012, last Thanksgiving. Sarah and I decided that we wanted to invite a Muslim family, Turkish Muslim family that lives near us, that are good friends of ours. The gentleman, Hakan, is not in the picture, actually. He was taking the picture. I couldn't find a picture that had him in it, unfortunately. But they have hosted us in their home. He was our guide when we went to Turkey. Very hospitable family. And so we decided we are going to invite them to our Thanksgiving. They are Turkish Americans. They've lived in the States for 6 years. They had never experienced an American Thanksgiving. I always like this little anecdote. They're from Turkey and they'd never eaten turkey, which they didn't find nearly as funny as we did. But anyway. But you have a picture here, actually, on the far left. This is Keith's daughter. Keith and his daughter, Allison, were there. And then Sarah and I and our daughter, Bryn. Then you have Nur Yildiz, the mother, and their young child, Beza, sweet, just sweetest little girl. And so we invited them over for Thanksgiving. You know, we were kind of entering into an experience that we didn't quite know what to do with. We didn't know how this was going to go. They strictly follow Islamic dietary laws. So we had all kinds of questions. I mean, preparing Thanksgiving is already a big task. When you have to do it halal and kosher and all of that, and you don't know anything about that, it becomes an even bigger task. But we thought, let's see how we do this. And so the first thing I did, I picked up my phone. And I called Saeed. I said, Saeed, you know, help me. Where can I get a halal turkey? And Saeed led me on he gave me some instructions, and then suddenly I was driving all over the metro area to halal grocery stores and different places and butcher shops and found a halal turkey. And then, you know, everything that we had to prepare for that meal had to be halal or kosher. All the ingredients down to, the oils that we used, the soups that we used, everything, at least had to be kosher. And so we spent a week or so going around reading the fine print labels and all these, items in different grocery stores. Going to special groceries around the metro area. I remember in one place, you know, we wanted to do this right. We wanted to give them a true Thanksgiving meal the way that we would have we would enjoy it if they weren't there, and be hospitable to them in that way. What's that?
I'm thinking of those deviled eggs.
Yeah. Very funny story there, yeah. You know, things that are so commonplace to us that you don't think about till someone from the outside asks. They were going around pointing at everything. Now, what is this? And what is this? And what is this? Oh, those are deviled eggs. And as soon as it comes out of your mouth, you think. And I remember Neur saying, and why do you call them deviled eggs? That's a good question. I don't know. Maybe there's some traditions we need to change. But anyway. We wanted to give them the best Thanksgiving meal we could. I went into a halal grocery at one point, and my goal was to find halal marshmallows, because you can't have Thanksgiving unless you have, you know, sweet potato casserole with marshmallows on top. I didn't know if such things existed in the world. So I walked in, and it was pretty obvious to everyone in that grocery that I stuck out like a sore thumb, and I didn't know what I was doing. And I walked up and sheepishly said to a guy up front, I said, do you have, or is there any such thing as halal marshmallows? And the whole little crowd of people around me started chuckling and laughing, and they were asking me questions, and I started explaining what we were trying to do, and I was feeling like a seventh grader again. But pretty quickly, they were so appreciative, and this one older woman with a full headscarf on, she wasn't going to shake my hand or grab my arm, but she grabbed the front of my cart, and she had this big smile on her face, and she said, oh, come, 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 and she grabbed the cart, and she started leading me by the cart around the grocery store. She took me, she found some halal marshmallows, and then she started saying, oh, and you need this, and you need this, and by the time I got up front, my bill had, like, tripled. But she was so happy and appreciative for what we were doing. But anyway, so I got the halal marshmallows, and we made the Sarah and worked very hard making this meal, and we did it together, and we came together, and we shared a Thanksgiving together. And it was, I can't tell you, I mean, you could say, well, we were the ones extending hospitality to them. Well, yeah, I guess we were, but where's the line between extending and receiving? I'm not sure. I mean, we had been in their home many times, or we'd been in their home and been received by them. We were returning that, but it was a shared thing. And I can just say this: before the meal began, we prayed together, and we thanked God for the meal. We thanked God for our friendship. We prayed for peace in our world and between our two communities. I prayed for their family, specifically, by name, each one of them. I prayed for Beza, the little girl sitting there. We prayed for our faith journeys and that God would reveal himself to us clearly in our lives. And we prayed for his guidance. And then we ate together.
That every time I hear that story, it's just as moving as it is for John. And the fact that I was able to have a small contributory role in it, I got a voicemail and a text message while I was in London saying, where do I find a halal turkey? And, I mean, the desperation in the text was like somebody needing his fix. And so now I've become a turkey pusher. You know, I'm like, let me see. You know, there's on the corner of Walton and, you know, just ask for the guy named Slim. And, you know, Muslim. And I remember telling my wife, I said, look, we got to help them out. I mean, he's really craving it. He's fiending. And so she said, look, just tell him to go down to this store. And I remember texting John back saying, but you've got to get it in advance because there is a rush on halal turkeys, you know. And why that's important is it shows how much Thanksgiving has become part of the American Muslim fabric, that it is this reconciliation of Muslims wanting to participate in the civil religious holiday of the country and to still also be true to their dietary strictures when it comes to halal. Now, on a personal level, my philosophy is that as long as it never oinked I'll eat it. Of course, others and those who come over to our home, especially in my wife's side of the family, are a little bit more observant about this. And when it comes to Thanksgiving in my home, and this is something that always comes up with our students, and they ask, well, what are you having for Thanksgiving? There's always this curiosity. I actually tell them that this is the one time in my life where I'm a fundamentalist. And I'm not a fundamentalist about being Muslim. I'm a fundamentalist when it comes to being Thanksgiving, that there is no food at my table that will not be there from the original meal. So when I saw the deviled eggs, I'm like, yeah, I don't remember that. That wouldn't pass. Nothing tandoori, nothing curry. And so people now know not to come up to my porch bringing a dish that was from India or from someplace else. I said, this is the one day of the year where I like to have it be as authentic as possible. And this harmonization of being Muslim, being American, and the compatibility of it has always been something that is part of my DNA. It's how I've been hardwired. One of the things that we talked about in class was Halloween. And some of the students asked me, because when we teach in the fall, of course, we get Halloween, we get Thanksgiving. What do you do about Halloween? I said, let me tell you an interesting story. When I was younger, my dad forbade me from going trick-or-treating. And it had nothing to do with Islam. He said, it is beneath my son to have to go beg for candy. He said, here's $10, go with your mom to the store and buy some candy. And I'm like, you're missing the point. Okay, so nothing about the pagan origins, nothing about dressing up as a devil or anything like that. It's about the begging thing. When my sister comes along, and she's 11 years younger, and she's daddy's little princess, and I'm working my way through this still, she asks him, can I go trick-or-treating? Of course, princess, you can. You take her trick-or-treating. So now Halloween becomes halal-oween. It becomes lawful. There's no longer begging. So I think what happened is somewhere along the lines, Dad read Marx along with Muhammad and changed his view. But it's amazing how in so many households there are similarities and there are contrasts. And my story about Halloween and about whether to celebrate it or not, and I know this is a big thing among a lot of Muslims in America, parallel those stories happening in very Christian homes. Those same kinds of issues and anxieties and hand-wringings about should we celebrate this? What about the pagan origins? What does this mean? Is it getting too sleazy? Is it getting too commercial? Those are the same discussions that happen in Muslim households every day. The only difference is that those discussions are happening in English, as well as Arabic, as well as Turkish, as well as Farsi, as well as in Swahili. They're happening in different languages as well. And this is part of the experience of growing up in Lapeer, Michigan for a better part of my life. One aside I would like to make regarding turkey, and by the way, I have it, and you're all witness to this. John has agreed, and I'm going to pay for it. He and I are going to get a Turkish massage when we go to Turkey in June, because I want him to experience what I've already experienced, which is getting thrown up against a wall like a piece of pasta to see if I'm done. It's worth all the money, and I'm thinking about getting a camera
all of your
my
money.
Head so that I can get a podcast of this so you can see how John is dealing with it. But I read on my news ticker today that Justin Bieber, and we all know who Justin Bieber is, right? And if you don't, just ask your kids or your grandkids. Justin Bieber was performing in Istanbul. Okay, so right then and there, it should tell you something about Turkey and about the receptivity to pop culture. And as he was performing, he stopped his heavily choreographed, heavily regimented, down-to-the-second routine twice. Waited for the azan, the call to prayer, to be broadcast, because I guess it was in an open-air amphitheater. Waited for the call to prayer to be recited, and then picked back up with his conference. Given the hour of the concert, coincided with the evening prayer and the night prayer. So he actually stopped it twice to demonstrate a respect for his surroundings. And I must admit, I'm not a believer. I'm not a fan of Justin Bieber. Don't care for his music. Don't care for the tattoos or the attitude and all. But I had to go ahead and give the guy some respect. I said, that is just a wonderful way of recognizing where one is and having the respect for the other, and something that he didn't have to do. I'm also reminded of one of my housemates in college named Chauncey, who was a member of the Church of Christ. Now, Chauncey's relationship to the Church of Christ was pretty almost untethered or attenuated. And one night, Cat Stevens, or the former Cat Stevens, the singer, was coming to a local high school to give a talk. And he had converted several years earlier to become Yusuf Islam, the artist formerly known as Cat Stevens. And so we went, because we were big fans of Cat Stevens' music, had seen Harold and Maude, of course. And the next morning, it was a Sunday morning, and I see, as I'm getting ready to go down to the dorm cafeteria for breakfast, Chauncey is dressed in a suit. And this is a guy who never dressed up. And he was wearing a trench coat. And I'm like, where are you going so early on a Sunday morning? And he said, I'm going to church. And, of course, my spontaneous and irreverent follow-up was, well, who died? And he said, I just felt inspired to go to church today. And I said, really? I said, why? He says, well, it's something that Cat Stevens said, or Yusuf Islam said. And I said, well, how interesting that what brought Chauncey back to the church was someone who had converted to Islam. But it resonated the same way, I think, that as Keith was describing, that there is something that hits a spiritual chord, even if it's in a different language, a different culture, or molded in a different theological structure. But this idea about being a neighbor and what is the power and importance of being neighborly really came home in Lapeer on 9/11. Now, I live half an hour south of Lapeer in Rochester Hills, but I mean, I'll never forget that, as I'm sure many of you won't. I remember sitting there watching the Today Show, watching the second tower get hit by the second plane live with my eldest daughter, who was sitting on my knee while I was having a cup of tea in the morning. And the phone rang nonstop from people wondering what to make of this. But that night, I got a call from my dad around 11:30 at night. And, of course, my first reaction was, are you okay? He says, yeah. He says, but I just wanted to tell you something that happened. My parents live in about an acre lot, and their driveway has part of it's paved and part of it is gravelly. So that's their version of early warning system. But you hear a car pull up on the gravel, you know somebody's coming over. And at 11 o'clock at night, they hear the gravel alarm, and my dad opens up the garage door, and he sees a squad car there from the Lapeer County Sheriff's Department. And my dad knows all the cops, never gets a ticket because they give old Doc Hahn the break, and he sees the two officers, and he knows them. He's gone hunting with them. And it's not uncommon for where my parents live in this neighborhood for cops to camp out in the driveway to catch speeders. So that makes my parents so popular. My dad goes up to the car and he says, hello, Larry, or whoever is the cop, knows him by first name. And they said, hey, Doc, how's it going? And my dad says, fine. And how's everything going with you? And they said, fine. They said, we were wondering if it's okay with you if we could just camp out here. And my dad says, of course. Can I bring you anything to eat, anything to drink? And he says, no, we're fine, and you don't have any donuts, so it's not part of our diet. My dad asked, you're most welcome to go ahead and be here. How long are you planning on being here? And he says, well, we're thinking about staying all night, if that's okay with you. My dad's thinking, still oblivious to everything, that, wow, there must be a rash of speeders tonight that they're trying to capture. And they said, well, if it's okay, we thought we'd stay here tonight because of what happened earlier this morning. And my dad is still a little bit perplexed, and he says, well, what do you mean? He says, well, you're family to us, and we know that. But there's some people out there, we're sad to say, Doc, who may not realize that about you. And so we just thought we'd hang out here and make sure that you're going to be okay. And that was 22 years in the making. My parents had already lived in Lapeer for 22 years. And the relationship that had organically built up over these 22 years of knowing people as patients, as hunting partners, as colleagues, as neighbors, it shows the kind of work that is required to have relationships built to become neighbors in the same capacity as one would develop relationships elsewhere. And I think back on the 22 years till that point of what it took, and living in Lapeer, going to high school, and thinking back on my neighbors, both in a literal and in a metaphoric sense, that it was never a matter of possibly anticipating a day like 9/11. It was never a kind of investment in when things go badly, we want to make sure that we're hedging our bets because nobody knows what's going to happen. But this natural process of just being oneself and engaging on a neighborly basis. I remember on Christmas Day of 1982, my dad had a heart attack. And fortunately, it wasn't a very severe one, but he was out of work for 6 weeks. And six doctors rotated through my dad's office and kept the appointment book active. And all the checks that came in were left in a pile as receivables on his desk, saying, this is what the weekly take was, Doc. Good luck to you. They never took a cut. They took the week off from their own practice, from their own vacation time, to help out somebody, to help out a colleague, to help out a brother, a neighbor. And one doctor said, listen, we know that things are probably going to be a bit dicey getting back up on your feet. And he left a blank check with his signature on it. He says, put what you need, pay it back when you can. I mean, fortunately, we never had to do that. It is moments like that that instill and restore my faith, not in God, that's pretty well embedded, but on those wobbly days when you wonder, how are we as a community, how are we as a society, how are we as a human race, it is at times like that that it all comes back and is restored.
We're down to our last 10 minutes of the last day here, and I want to close with a few thoughts. And I wish we could stay here for hours more and tell more of these stories and hear some of your stories and let you experience some more of Saeed's stories. But we need to come to a close here. I've written some of this down just because I want to say it well. We know that we're ending these sessions, and thank you for those of you that have been here for these 3 days, for honoring us with your presence and for letting us share something of our journey with you. But we know we're ending these sessions. As we end, every time we teach our class, every class session and every semester ends with the way we're ending this week. We're ending with many unresolved issues floating in the air. I've had a number of you come down, and those of us, we all have, saying, oh, well, what about this issue? Are you going to cover that? Are you going to cover this? Are you going to cover? And it makes us realize how inadequate these presentations are and how little we have covered. There's a lot of unresolved. There are many unresolved issues still floating in the air. There's so much more we could say, should have said, would want to say. There are unanswered questions and maybe some exposed nerves in this room, and we acknowledge that. But we do hope, that at least we have modeled and encouraged and challenged all of us to ask some really important questions, that we've encouraged respectful dialogue, and that at least we've tried to open up the imagination for some practical ideas of what to do in our different contexts to address these important issues. And mostly, we hope that we have encouraged and challenged all of us to imagine again and to try to embody on a deeper level what Jesus calls us to when he tells us to love our neighbors, to love our enemies, to do unto others as we would have them do unto us. And that really is the rub for all of this. I want to end our three sessions with one brief story and then a few brief reflections about a parable of Jesus. I got a picture for this story. I want to briefly tell you the story, and you can look more up about this gentleman online, but briefly tell you the story of Azim Kamisa, pictured there in the top left. Lives in San Diego. On January 21st, 1995, his 20-year-old son named Tariq Kamisa, who was a college student at the time, had a job delivering pizzas. On January 21st of 95, he was making a pizza delivery, and he was robbed, And then he was shot and killed, making a, you know, the senseless kind of act of violence that took Azim Kamisa's son away from him. He was shot and killed by a 14-year-old, a gang member named Tony Hicks, who's pictured on this page as well. This became a very high-profile case, by the way. Tony Hicks became the first child in California under the age of 16 to be tried as an adult. And he's currently serving his 25-to-life sentencing. And this is true for his whole family, but Azim was born in India, raised in East Africa, made his way to America, devout Muslim. And at the time of this tragedy, a senseless tragedy, he decided, what was natural to him. In his pain, he turned to his faith. And the story of Azim Kamisa and his family is an amazing story of someone that turned to his Islamic faith. He found his moral and spiritual strength in the Quran and Islamic teachings. And from those teachings, he became quickly convinced that his calling was to forgive and to reach out to the one who took his son. And so he did. He started visiting the prison, started visiting Tony, reached out to Tony's family, especially his grandfather, a man named Ples Felix, and really befriended Ples Felix. Ples Felix, African-American gentleman who had grown up in the South as a Baptist. And so you have this amazing story of this devout Muslim reaching out to this Baptist from the South, extending radical forgiveness in the name of Allah, and it changed Ples Felix's life, and it changed Tony Hicks's life. And you can go online, you can watch the videos, you can hear their own testimonies. Azim Kamisa founded the Tariq Kamisa Foundation to stop youth violence, and it's an active foundation, and you can follow it online. He's advocating right now for Tony's early release, and he has a job at the foundation for Tony when he gets out. And to hear this young man's testimony, I tell you, it's an incredible story of forgiveness and redemption. This story raises all kinds of theological questions for me. Azim Kamisa embodies things that the only way I know to attribute what he embodies, the only thing I know to call it, is the fruit of the Holy Spirit. That's what my theological upbringing causes me to call it. I don't know what else to call it. And I'm telling you, that raises a lot of theological questions for me that I don't have the answers for. But I think they're really good questions. Luke 10. One of the best-known parables of Jesus is the parable of the Good Samaritan. And just like every parable, there are multiple lessons, multiple layers of what we need to learn from the different parables. But this parable in particular, I think, has an application that is especially relevant for our discussions and our days that we've spent together. This interpretation isn't original to us, but I just think it's especially relevant. The Good Samaritan, in many ways, and here's the relevant point. Samaritans were, to the Jews of Jesus' day, what Muslims are to many Christians today. The parallels are really striking. And I don't have time to go into all the debates and the disputes about the origins of the Samaritans and the different theories about all of that. But following the Jewish understanding of that you can read about, especially in passages like 2 Kings chapter 17. The parallels are striking. Jews and Samaritans in Jesus' day, just like Christians and Muslims today, shared complex historical and theological connections to one another. They were both monotheistic, both claimed to worship the one true Creator God. Both Jews and Samaritans claimed to be the true children of Abraham. But Samaritans, like Muslims today, and we could say a lot more about this, but for the brevity here, Samaritans, like Muslims today, embraced only parts of the Jewish scriptures and only certain interpretations of the Jewish scriptures. The Samaritans directed their belief and their worship to a different mountain than did the Jews, Mount Gerizim in Samaria instead of Mount Zion. Read John 4 and Jesus' encounter with the Samaritan woman. Furthermore, as all of you know, the Samaritans in Jesus' day were mistrusted. They were feared. They were seen as infidels. They were seen as terrorists. The animosity was thick. This is in Luke 10. Back up just a few verses into Luke 9, and you see the disciples, and especially James and John, they were upset with the Samaritans. They didn't like the way they were responding to Jesus, and they are asking Jesus, can we call down fire from heaven and destroy these people? They were ready for a little shock and awe. And you move into Luke 10. First, Jesus rebukes James and John for even thinking that way. And then within a few verses, you have a lawyer that comes up to Jesus and asks him a deep question. Not a little trivial question about religious practice. He asks him a central question about eternal life and about living into the greatest commandments, those things that define faithful Jewish life. And Jesus could have answered his question and engaged this lawyer in so many ways, but he chose to answer him by telling the story of a merciful Samaritan, an infidel, a terrorist. And he chose to tell that story of the mercy of a Samaritan in contrast to the religious and political purities of a Levite and a priest. It's a powerful story. And we could say a lot here, but let me just say two things. Number one, I think the teaching of this parable at least reminds us that being neighborly and showing mercy gets at the heart of Jesus' message in ways that religious identity and piety cannot on their own. And number two, Jesus could have made that point, that very point that I just said about neighborliness and mercy. He could have made that point without mentioning or bringing up the sensitivities and all the political and theological issues between Jews and Samaritans, but he chose to do it that way. And he forced his hearers to grapple with the issues around them, the tense political and theological issues around them, and forced them to grapple with the surprising reversals of the kingdom. Jesus said to his Jewish audience, in effect, do you want to be a good, God-fearing Jew, pursuing eternal life and obeying the commands? Then this is how you do it. You need to live like this merciful Samaritan. And I can imagine today Jesus saying to us, do you want to be a good, faithful follower of the Christ? Do you want to provide a deep and true and authentic witness to the Lamb? Here's how you do it. You need to live like and behave like Azim Kamisa. That opens all kinds of cans of worms. But I think they're the kind of cans of worms that Jesus opened all the time. And we're left here to wrestle with it and to learn from it. This doesn't call us to change or to compromise our commitments or our beliefs as Christians, as Christ followers. It certainly doesn't. We've shared with you over the last couple of days, all three of us, well, speak for Keith and me right now, these exchanges and these kinds of exchanges with Saeed and others haven't compromised our Christian faith. It has deepened it. And Saeed says the same thing as you have witnessed. But at least all of our discussions, all of our searches for truth, all of our debates and interactions, all of the things that we try to navigate in our world and our faith, if we want to be Christ followers, those things have to be guided by mercy and by love and by neighborliness. God bless us all as we seek to be faithful to that holy calling. And thank you so much for being a part of this journey with us. Thank you.